This is Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Today on Writer's Voice, excerpts from four of our 10 best shows of 2019. Then we'll talk about the six we couldn't get on the show today. You'll find links to those at writersvoice.net. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Well, it's that time of year when media folks like me look back and try to pick out the 10 best of whatever we produced or reviewed this year. You might as well gather them all up in a hat and toss the contents against the wall. I loved all my darlings. But there were some standouts, and so I winnowed down the list of about 20 to 10 and then picked four to air excerpts from. Here they are. In January, we talked with Native American writer and critic David Troyer about his book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, Native America from 1890 to the Present. It's a sweeping history of the resilience of Native America in the face of oppression and injustice. Then, in our May interview with Lori Gottlieb, she told us about her best-selling memoir, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, a therapist, her therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. In the memoir, Gottlieb invites us into her world as both clinician and patient, examining the truths and fictions we tell ourselves and others. Then in June, Eve Ensler came on the show to talk about The Apology, her searing memoir of sexual, emotional, and physical abuse at the hands of her father. It's written in his voice in the form of an apology to her. Finally, in September, we spoke with science fiction novelist, blogger, and technology activist Cory Doctorow. His book, Radicalized, brings together four speculative fiction novellas connected by social, technological, and economic visions of today, and what America could be in the very near future. We'll listen to those excerpts from those four interviews, and finally, we'll mention the remaining six of our 10 best of 2019, and it was really hard to make the choice among so many great show episodes this year. You'll find blurbs about and links to those at writersvoice.net. But now, let's start with David Troyer. His book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, is a brilliant examination of the post-conquest history of Native America through the lens of survival and resilience. He doesn't shrink from describing the horrors visited on Native Americans by the white man, but he celebrates the indomitable spirit of the tribes and their peoples, melding history with reportage and memoir. Tracing the tribe's distinctive cultures from first contact, he explores how the depredations of each era spawn new modes of survival. Time magazine named The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee as one of the best books of 2019. This is just a terrific book and beautifully written, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee. You set out in this book to counter the common narrative about the American Indian and to pose a different narrative, one that emphasizes resilience and strengths of the Native American community. And you said you wanted a book that would dismantle the tale of our demise by way of a new story. Tell us more about that. What is the counter narrative? What's the narrative first and then the counter narrative?
It's always seemed to me that the only kind of story that people tell about Native American people is one of destruction and loss. And it's easy to see why that's the dominant narrative. I mean, we have lost a lot. We went from being the sole inhabitants and owners of North America in 1492 to within a few hundred years controlling much, much less of it. But I remember reading Dee Brown's "Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee" when I was in college, and I remember being really frustrated and really really hurt by that book, because as much of an ally as Dee Brown was, and he was a tremendous ally and of and proponent of Native people. In the very first page of that book, he says something to the effect of, "This book takes, you know, this book focuses on the Plains Wars. I start in 1850 and I end in 1890 at the massacre at Wounded Knee Creek, where the culture and civilization of the American Indian was finally destroyed." It's something like that. And he goes on to say that, you know, if you happen to travel to a modern Indian reservation and see the squalor and poverty and hopelessness, perhaps by reading this book, you will understand why. And I remember feeling a lot when I read that introduction when I was 19 years old. I remember feeling both happy that someone was paying attention to the contours of our lives, and also at the same time silenced by his assessment that we were gone, that we were destroyed, that the culture and civilization of the American Indian was gone. And I remember thinking to myself, well, I'm not gone, and my tribe's not gone, and my community's not gone, and we're here. And we're not just here, but we're doing all sorts of things. And so I wanted, and I searched for years for stories that told the stories of our lives rather than the story of our death. And I didn't find any. And so, as Toni Morrison says, if there's a book you want to read and it doesn't exist, well, then you should probably write it.
Yeah. And as you mentioned Wounded Knee, it's really emblematic of this. And you talk about Wounded Knee. You know, I think the picture we have is just of the massacre, but something else survived. So tell us about Wounded Knee itself, the original one, and what you saw as coming out of that, that is different than the narrative that we have.
Well, Wounded Knee was a massacre that occurred on Pine Ridge Reservation in December of 1890 after the murder of Sitting Bull. There was widespread anxiety among the Native people in South Dakota. It was a pretty tense time. There was a military buildup. The government kept pouring more troops and more arms into the Great Sioux Reservation because the army and the government were afraid of an uprising because of the increasing popularity of the ghost dance. So everyone was on edge, Native people, the government, and when you have a lot of different people who don't trust each other on edge and you have a lot of guns, something bad is almost inevitably going to happen. And sure enough, there were some bands of Lakota who were fleeing, and they were surrounded by the military. There was a scuffle. It's unclear who shot first or how it began, but almost immediately after that scuffle and after some guns went off, the government opened fire with Hotchkiss cannons on largely unarmed and predominantly American Indian women and children. And when it was done, estimates vary, but between 120 and over 300 Native people were killed. And it wasn't just this initial flurry of violence. It was a sort of a bloodlust kind of took over the military, where they chased women and children down on horseback upwards of a mile or two down these ravines and shot them in the back and mutilated their bodies. And for almost instantly, that massacre became emblematic of, for lots of people, the death of American Indians, for the rapaciousness of the government. Sort of it stood in for the entire, you know, 200-year relationship between, well, not quite 200 years, but 150-year relationship between the U.S. government and Native people. And it was an awful massacre. It also happened right at the time when the government officially declared the frontier closed and the United States officially settled. And Frederick Jackson Turner's frontier hypothesis was promoted by him at the Columbia World Exposition, I think, 3 years later. And it was really a turning point. This was the point at which tribes ceased to be thought of as free or unencumbered, and the long sort of winter of reservation life was to have begun. in reality, the reservation system was already well established. And in reality, our lives didn't end. And one thing that always struck me about the massacre is that everyone has always, of course, with good reason, focused on the men, women, and children who were so brutally butchered, but no one paid much attention to the people who survived. And even if you put the figures at 300 dead, many, many more walked away from Wounded Knee and went about their lives and got married and found work and found ways to practice their native religions, and some converted to Christianity and some went to school and some didn't. They sort of fanned out into America and continued to live. And those are the people I wanted to focus on. And that's what I wanted the book to focus on, were the ways in which we've been living ever since 1890. And I felt that if we looked closely and with artistry at Indian lives rather than Indian deaths, we would see something different about us, but we'd also see something different about our country.
Something different about our country?
Sure. I mean, people have always thought of, you know, Indians as in America, but not of America. And I've always felt that if you really want to understand what this country is about, if you want to understand its ideals, and if you want to understand its mistakes, if you want to understand the way power works inside our government and despite our government, if you want to understand the effects of federal policy or the importance of the composition of the Supreme Court, if you want to understand the relationship between the federal government and states, you need to look at Indian country. There were more Supreme Court decisions about American Indian issues in the 1970s and 80s than there were Supreme Court decisions about banking, about finance, about the death penalty, about reproductive rights. And the Supreme Court sort of understood itself, or sort of came to be what it is, because it paid attention to the tricky issue of tribal sovereignty. That's just one example. So if you want to understand America, you have to look at us.
Could you say a little bit more about how that Supreme Court decision over tribal sovereignty?
Many decisions, like dozens of decisions.
Pick one.
Well, for instance, I mean, the argument about federal power versus states' rights has been going on since the country was founded. It's pretty unclear how much power should the states have, how much power should the government have, should the government have. All of those issues have been tricky, but there are really three powers at play in the land, namely states, the federal government, and Indian tribes. And so when issues like tribal gaming came up in the 1980s, the Supreme Court had to think hard about, well, gaming is really a state issue, but tribes aren't states. They're sovereign nations within the United States. So how do we make decisions about how tribes game in states that don't allow gaming? And it brings into sharp focus what power states have, for example, and what powers they don't to regulate things like gaming or banking and so on.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with David Troyer about his book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee. It's a sweeping history of the resilience of Native American people in the face of oppression and injustice. Louise Erdrich, who writes from a Native American, mostly about Native American issues, wrote a whole novel about the different jurisdiction over violence against women. I mean, women who are raped or murdered, if they're raped or murdered on a reservation, who does it if they're raped or murdered off a reservation? Is this something of what you're talking about as well?
Sure. Congress passed the Violence Against Women Act, I think, in the 1990s, and it was recently updated to include broader protections for Native women. One of the problems with all these overlapping and jigsaw jurisdictions, federal crimes, state crimes, et cetera, and tribal courts as well, were that tribal courts could only prosecute perpetrators of sexual violence against Native women on Native land if the perpetrators were Native. But the Justice Department has recently issued reports suggesting that over 70% of violent crimes perpetrated against Native women are perpetrated by non-Native men. Tribes were very interested in prosecuting crimes against Native women. Counties, not so much. The state, not so much. And so a lot of these non-Native perpetrators sort of went unpunished. But through a lot of hard work and advocacy, the Violence Against Women Act was strengthened to give, for the first time, tribal courts and tribal police departments jurisdiction over non-Native men. They can charge and try non-Native people in tribal court for the first time. That's huge.
That was David Troyer talking with us in January 2019 about his book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee. To hear the rest of the interview, go to writersvoice.net. This is Writer's Voice, and we're airing excerpts from four of our 10 best show episodes of 2019. Next up, we spoke with Lori Gottlieb in May about her funny and thought-provoking look behind the scenes of a therapist's world from both sides of the couch. It's called Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. One day, Gottlieb is a therapist helping patients in her Los Angeles practice. The next, her own world comes crashing down when her longtime boyfriend announces he's leaving. Enter Wendell, the quirky but seasoned therapist in whose office she suddenly lands. As Gottlieb explores the inner chambers of her patients' lives, she finds that the questions they're struggling with are the very ones she's now bringing to her therapist. Gottlieb writes The Atlantic's Dear Therapist advice column. This was a wonderful book for me in particular to read because I spent 10 years as a therapist. What's so wonderful about it is that you really talk about it from both sides, from you as a therapist and you as a client. How did that come about?
Well, as you can imagine, I never, I didn't sit down one day and say, I'm going to write a book about my own experience in therapy. I never could have anticipated that I would do something like that. It came about because I was, and I write about this a little bit in the book, that I was supposed to be writing a book about happiness, and I was actually miserable. And writing that book was making me miserable. And through, I was starting off as a therapist at that time, and you can't really go through your training and not want to get it something very deep and very real. And I think that the book that I was trying to write was just scratching the surface of what I was seeing in the therapy room. And I wanted to bring the therapy room to readers because I feel like we don't talk about those things enough and we don't talk about them in a real way enough. And so I thought about just bringing my therapy room where I'm the therapist to readers. But then I thought that was somewhat disingenuous because we are people too, and I wanted people to see that we're more the same than we are different. And so I ended up wanting to show how I landed in therapy after a crisis and what that evolution was like and how it was very similar to what my patients were going through.
Yes, and it's interesting that you just said you started out with really what was the more fundamental crisis, which was around writing this book, but that's not what got you into therapy.
Right, right. And I think so often people come to therapy with one thing and they end up realizing that the issue is something deeper. And I don't say that to scare people, because I think that people have this idea that you go to therapy and you never leave. And it's very much not like that. In fact, our goal from day one is to get you to leave. We want you to feel better. We want you to feel better as quickly as possible. And we want the change to be lasting so that you don't need us. So I think that so often people will come in and they'll say, you know, this just happened with my relationship, or this just happened with my parent, or this just happened with my sibling or my boss. And really, there's some pattern that's going on that they're not aware of. And if they can just understand more about that pattern, they can make different choices in their lives, and they won't have so much trouble.
You start the book out with, I'd say, probably one of the toughest cases of the worried well. I mean, he's not really well. This isn't somebody who is, like, at risk for, you know, harming themselves or others. But, you know, it's garden variety therapy. Very tough case. Guy named John. Tell us about him, and what was so difficult about this case?
John was a very self-absorbed Hollywood producer who had trouble seeing his own role in his suffering. And so he externalized everything. Everybody else was the problem. Everybody else was an idiot. He knew better. You know, what we might call narcissistic. And he was demeaning. He was insulting. He was rude to me. He fundamentally, you know, saw the world through a very distorted lens. And yet he was highly successful. But he was having trouble in his marriage, and he was having trouble sleeping, and he didn't realize that the source of his problem was something else. And I didn't want to sort of spoil what it is, because it was quite a shock to me. And I think that's part of what happens in therapy, is that people tell you stories, and they're only telling you a version of the story from their point of view, and they're not telling you everything. And so you have a very limited view until you really start to get to know them. And what came out later, I never would have seen coming.
Yeah. But, you know, he's tough because, as you call him a narcissist, and that's, you know, that's in kind of the category of personality disorders. Could you tell us a difference between personality disorders and mood disorders? And then I want to go back to the personality disorders.
Yeah, so personality disorders are what we call characterological disorders, meaning that in any environment, a person has a certain way of relating. So somebody with, say, borderline personality disorder will have an intense fear of abandonment. They will see the world in very black or white ways. They're quick to anger. They get hurt very easily and very quickly. You know, so that's something that's in their character, which can be changed, but it takes a lot of work. A mood disorder is something like you're going through a depression. Mood disorders are things that you know you have it and you don't want to have it. A personality disorder is something where you don't know that you have a problem. You think that everybody else is the problem.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. And it kind of points to one of the difficulties about therapy and even working with people, say, with personality disorders, and that is that they don't tend to come into therapy. So what I want to ask you is, how do you work with people who don't think they have the problem?
Yeah, well, what happens is they might come into therapy, but it's because they want everyone else to change. Mm-hmm. So they're coming in because they want you to help them get somebody else in their life to change. My partner's doing this. Help me to get my partner to do it differently, right? Mm-hmm. So they don't want to change. They don't think that they have any role in what's going on. So that's sort of the issue. Or, you know, with narcissists, they generally, you know, there are certain kinds of personality disorders that you see less of in therapy. Borderline you see more of, because they're in so much pain in their relationships, but they think that the other person is the problem.
Right, whereas narcissists don't tend to do that. You know, I want to ask you just quickly, now that we're on narcissism, there's a book that was published after Trump came into office that was an interesting collection of essays by various psychologists and psychiatrists who, you know, violated what's called the Goldwater Rule, that you're not supposed to diagnose somebody that you haven't actually interviewed. Mm-hmm. And they diagnosed him as a malignant narcissist. I'd say people, you know, in the field would probably nod their heads at that. Talk about the issue of diagnosis, and do you think you can make a diagnosis like that in a book like that?
Yeah, so in Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, I do talk about diagnosis and its limitations. And one of the things I say is that diagnosis can be helpful in that it helps you understand, you know, generally what this person might be experiencing, and also in terms of treatment plan, how you might be able to help them, what's most effective in that situation. But when I'm sitting across from somebody, I'm not looking at, say, John as, oh, there's the narcissist. He's John, who happens to be sometimes kind of an asshole, right? Mm-hmm. But there's more to him than that. And so I don't want to lose the person in the diagnosis. If I only looked at John as a narcissist, I would lose every other thing about him that made me like him, that made me find his vulnerabilities, his tender spots, his humanity. And so I'm very wary of diagnosis in that way. I use it in the back of my mind. It's there because it helps me. But when I'm sitting in a room with someone, you know, I'm interacting with them as a human being, and I don't want to trap somebody with a label because they think that then I will miss things and our relationship will suffer.
Yeah, it's maybe a little bit like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. You know, once you kind of slap a label on somebody, then you're only going to be seeing certain things.
Yes.
Now, people often come into therapy wanting to be told what to do. They're in pain. They don't know what to do. That's why they're there. But that's not really the therapist's job, is it?
It's not. And it's not because we're withholding information, right? It's not, you know, part of it is that people assume that we have the quote unquote right answer. And, you know, as my therapist said to me one day, he said, you know, I only know what I would do. I don't know what you should do. And of course, then I said, okay, well then just tell me, what would you do? You know, I completely missed his meaning in the moment, but later I realized what he was saying, which was, you need to learn to trust yourself. You need to learn to figure out what to do, because you're the one who gets to choose what you want to do with your life. And the more you can understand yourself, the better the decisions will be. So the goal of a therapist is not to make decisions, just like with our kids, right? We don't want to make all their decisions for them. We want them to develop a sense of trust in themselves. We want them to develop a sense of good judgment. And that's what we help them to do so that they won't need us. And the other part of it is, you know, there's this word that I love that I actually have posted up in my office, ultra-crepidarianism, which is basically giving advice outside of your knowledge. And you know, I might be seeing a couple, for example, and I might be thinking, oh man, they should really get divorced, right? but maybe for them, maybe I wouldn't want to be in that marriage, but maybe for them, it is the better thing for them, right? You know, and also, you know, people come all the time with these big life decisions, like, should I have another baby? I don't know if you should have another baby. You know, I know how I would make that decision, but I can't make that decision for you.
Lori Gottlieb talking with Writer's Voice in May of 2019. There's more of that conversation at writersvoice.net. After the break, we continue with excerpts from 4 of our 10 best show episodes from 2019. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Today, we're taking a look back to some of our best shows of 2019. I have to say, this was one of our best years for terrific interviews, so it was really, really hard to choose. But we're playing excerpts from 4 of the 10 I picked out, and we have links to the rest at writersvoice.net. We'll tell you what the remaining 6 are at the end of the show. So let's cue up the tape for our next interview with Eve Ensler, playwright, women's rights activist, and founder of the globally acclaimed Vagina Monologues. Like millions of women, Ensler has been waiting much of her lifetime for an apology. Starting at the age of 5, she was sexually and then physically abused by her father. After years of work as an activist in the global movement to combat violence against women, Ensler decided she would wait no longer. She could imagine an apology by her, for her, to her. The book that emerged, The Apology, transforms the abuse she suffered with unflinching truthfulness and compassion into a healing journey of liberation. This book, The Apology, it's an apology that you write to yourself in the voice of your father. Now, he has been dead for 31 years. He subjected you to terrible emotional and sexual incest, as well as physical abuse when at the age of 11 you began to defy him. What was the process by which you became able finally to write this book?
Well, that's a good question. I think it was a combination of forces. I think for one thing, all my childhood, I waited for an apology. I think one of the reasons I was always writing apology letters was secretly hoping they would kind of stimulate his desire to write an apology to me. And I think so there's that piece, right? And then having worked in the movement to end violence against women for so many years, and with this new amazing iteration of Me Too, I've been thinking, okay, we've told our stories. We've broken the silence. We've built the shelters. We've opened hotlines. But in all this time, I have never heard a man make a public, thorough, authentic apology. And it started to really hit me. Okay, I started to ask around, has anybody heard a public, thorough, authentic apology from a man? And nobody had. And the few men who have written after they've been accused or after their careers have collapsed have written about mainly how terrible it's been for them, you know, with kind of a underlying self-pity about the hard luck they've faced. So I started to think there's something here. There's something in this no apology that's core to what we have to look at if we're going to go to the next level of really ending violence against women and girls, all women and girls. And so I thought to myself, well, maybe I need to write the apology that I've been waiting for. And maybe I need to create the words and say the words and really look at what is an apology. What is the anatomy of an apology? What are the tenets of an apology? What would I need to hear in order to get free?
So tell us what are some of the tenets of an apology, and you maybe give us an example of how you follow that in this book.
There's a bunch of things. I think for one thing, it's a humbling. It's the perpetrator or the abuser making himself or herself vulnerable. It's an equalizer. There can't be anybody on top and anyone on the bottom. It's a connection. The second piece of it is I think it's a thorough, detailed accounting of what you've done and what your motivation was behind what you've done. The liberation is in the details. It can't be, I'm sorry if I hurt you, or I'm sorry if I did this thing to you, or any of that. It's got to be very specific and very exact. And then I think it's really allowing yourself to feel what your victim felt when you did what you did to her. What were the long-term impacts of that on her, on her family, on her community? And then it's going deep inside yourself to look at what brought you to do those things. What in your childhood? What in the acculturation into patriarchy and toxic masculinity? What in your life led you to become or go from being a kind of tender, wondrous child, boy, to somebody who was capable of raping, of harassing, of beating, of demeaning, of abusing a woman or another human being? And then I think the last piece of that is becoming accountable and apologizing and evidencing that you're not capable of doing something like that ever again.
You know, there were so many points in this book where I was just enraged at your father, that I felt he was just an incredible monster, and which I think he was. And in the book, you do excavate the backstory, what led to him being who he was. How did you walk that line between compassion and condemnation.
Well, I think that was the hardest part of the book, because I think, you know, it took me many years to get ready to write this book. You know, I didn't, and I want to say it's an offering. It's not a prescription. It's not a have to. If this idea works for survivors, do it. If it doesn't, that's fine. But I was at a point in my life where I was really beginning to feel a freedom coming into my life. And I felt there were parts of me that were still hooked into this kind of ongoing narrative or relationship with me being a perpetual victim to my father's abuser or perpetrator. And I wanted to get free of that. I wanted to be living in another narrative, another paradigm. And I think part of that meant I had to let myself see who my father was and what made my father what he was. I think the other piece of that is that we're often as survivors haunted by the why. Why did my boyfriend drug me and rape me on a date? Why did my father want to kill his daughter? Why? And I think going back and looking at what made my father who he was really began to give me missing pieces to the story of that why. And that really helped free me, because it got it out of this amorphous, you know, this general feeling of you're just a bad person and bad things happen, and this abstracted thing into a very specific timeline of my father's evolution or de-evolution into a sadist and an abuser. And I have to say that feeling for my father in the course of this book, feeling the pain he had undergone as a child, was really hard, but it really turned my father. You know, I think as survivors, we hold our perpetrators inside us, right? If someone rapes you or beats you or demeans you, they enter you and they're embedded in you. And I think what I learned doing this book is that we can turn how they live in us in another direction. My father went from this monolithic monster to an apologist, from this terrifying entity to a broken, wounded child. And in that sense, he lost agency over me and power, you know?
Agency and power. Yes. And yet you write this book in his voice. I mean, I can barely imagine how difficult that was. And there's even a place in which he asks, is it you who's writing it, you, Eve? Of course, you are writing it. Or is it him who's writing it? And that's actually a real question.
It's a real question to me, to be honest with you. I mean, I think once I opened the portal to his voice and to him to come through, there were moments when I really don't know who was writing this book. You know, it's not my vocabulary. It's certainly not that kind of authorial voice. Isn't my voice. You know, I think people live so deeply inside us, our parents, people we're very familiar with, people we have been very impacted by. And I went into kind of a 4-month trance state. This is the only way I can describe it, where I worked on this morning, noon, and night, and he would show up and talk. And who is what? I don't know. It was a conjuring.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with playwright, author, and activist Eve Ensler about her latest book, The Apology. And now give us a sense of the abuse when it started. You started at the age of 5, but I think it in many ways started before that, because there was a kind of emotional incest from the very beginning. Am I right?
Yeah, I think you are. I guess I didn't experience it that or understand it as such till much later. I think my father, I think he adored me, you know, and he was obsessed with me. And it's interesting, because I think one of the things that damaged my father the most as a boy was that he was adored. He was the golden boy. He was the divine right of kings. And yet that adoration wasn't love. It was a kind of a projected idealization of his parents onto him, which I don't know if it had much to do with who he was at all. And so all these pieces of himself that didn't fit into that ideal image, he had to bury, right? And eventually they metastasized and it surfaced at a later point in what he called the shadow man. And I think to some degree, my father did very similar things to me. He had this idealization of me, this worship of me that, of course, it feels very heady. Of course, you feel fantastic that someone thinks you're so special. And yet at the same time, you feel kind of weird, you know, like you haven't earned it, or what is it, or what does it have to do with me? And then I think that then led him to cross a line where he began to sexually invade and abuse me. And I think part of it is that my father, when he was a boy, was never allowed his own tenderness. He was never allowed to be tender, to express tenderness to himself, to express tenderness in the world. And so all that was pushed underground. And I think when I was born, I kind of catalyzed this overwhelming feeling of tenderness in him that he didn't know what to do with. He had never learned how to sit with it or just feel it or experience it without doing something about it, exploiting it or having it or crushing it or raping it or, you know, conquering it or making it go away. And I think this is something we do to boys. We don't allow them to have their tenderness. We shut that down. We cut that off. We tell them to man up and not be weak and not be vulnerable and not cry. And we can go down the list. So I think that sexual invasion and that sexual abuse was his attempt to cope or to deal with what he was feeling in a very kind of perverse way.
I mean, it's pretty extreme too. But you mentioned before boys. I mean, you do make this larger point. You know, I think at one point he references a Pandora's box, which is really a Pandora's box of toxic masculinity. And he talks about bargaining, manipulating, holding his own interests above all else. I think that last one was a real clue to, you know, whether he was being, you know, so-called sweet to you or being abusive or being sexual with you. All of that was just simply all about him.
All about him. All about him. And I think this incapacity to feel empathy, to break out of that kind of toxic masculinity, which forms as this kind of diabolical narcissism, right? Where your concerns and your needs and your way is the only thing that matters. And the belief that you're entitled to that and privileged to that. And certainly the world has let men believe that for a long time. And so I think he made excuses to himself to justify what he must have known was wrong and crossing a very diabolical boundary, right? But he took care of his needs. And in doing that, he tore the basic foundation of my humanity in some way, you know?
Eve Ensler. Hear the rest of that interview at writersvoice.net. This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. And now for our final excerpt from our list of 10 best shows of 2019. In September, we talked with science fiction novelist, blogger, and technology activist Cory Doctorow. Doctorow is one of the globe's leading thinkers about the internet and the digital commons, and also finds time to write speculative fiction that's both entertaining and thought-provoking. Doctorow's latest fiction foray is Radicalized, a collection of four novellas set in the near future that aims a sharply honed lance of satire at today's political and social inequalities. Radicalized creates an all too real vision of the dystopian possibilities we're headed for, but it's also a celebration of the human impulse to break the chains of corporate control. We have talked with you before about your books, Makers and Walkaway, both of which I loved. But this one, Radicalized, is actually so far my favorite. It's four novellas of speculative fiction that seem so real because they stretch current reality just a little bit to reveal where we do seem to be going as a society. And they reveal the core of the sickness of our society, I think. And where does that sickness lie for you?
Well, I am leery to ascribe unitary causes to complex phenomena. And one of the things that I try to get at in this book is that there are a lot of things happening at the same time. And they interact with each other and they feed off of each other or they dampen each other. And I kind of feel like we need to tug on the end of the string and see if that loosens the knot a little. So I can give you some string ends that I perceive, and maybe if we tug on those, we will loosen the knot enough to reveal other entanglements further down. So for example, I think the big one is inequality. We're living at a moment that is more unequal than at any time since the Gilded Age. It's a level of inequality that surpasses France on the eve of the French Revolution. And one of the epiphenomena of inequality, one of the things that inequality kind of generates along the lines, is a kind of incoherence about what is and isn't true. Because as a smaller and smaller number of people get richer and richer, our ability to describe the factual nature of the universe becomes more and more contingent on not upsetting a rich person. And so, you know, a good example of that would be climate denial, right? There is clearly a business model for taking the already uncertain process of using science to determine the far-off impacts of complex interactions between climate and carbon and other gases. And because that relationship is complicated already, if you throw in just a little bit of expensively sown doubt, you can create a very long-term incoherent picture about what is and isn't true. But, you know, that is radiated into so many of our other truth-seeking exercises. And I think that when you live in a complex technological society, there's probably nothing less appreciated or more important than truth-seeking, right? Finding out whether or not the structural steel that's holding up your roof was adequate to the task, or whether the pesticides being used to grow your food are going to give you cancer, or whether vaccines are safe, or whether opioids are safe. I mean, these are all important factual questions that have some political valence, like, you know, we might ask ourselves if opioids are safe and then for whom they're safe. We might say, oh, well, you know, the harm mostly arises to the user of the opioid and therefore it's your own choice. Or we might say, oh, no, actually the harm redounds to their family and society, and so they should get a look in too. But all of those exercises are increasingly cabined off by the inability to do or say things in official contexts that upset the donor class that keep our political machine running. And so this has produced a kind of reeling incoherence where we no longer agree not just on what is true, but we also no longer agree on how we can know whether a thing is true or not, right? We used to say a thing is true if the best evidence pointed to it, but now that we don't trust the evidence gathering processes, we say a thing is true if someone we think of as trustworthy tells us it is. And that creates these weird cults of personality where if you believe Alex Jones on one thing, you end up buying in to Alex Jones on all things, and you get this rise of conspiratorial thinking. And we tend to attribute that rise to the compelling speech of Alex Jones. But Alex Jones has been saying crazy things for a long time without his followership appreciably growing. What seems to have changed is not that Alex Jones got a lot better at delivering his message, but that we all became much more willing to believe that conspiracies existed, in part because we kept learning about conspiracies.
My rule of thumb is often to think about who does this benefit, you know, because I have a certain analysis of the power in society that conforms very much to what you write about in this book, Cory Doctorow, in Radicalized. But, you know, you're giving me a picture of maybe that's not always the only thing that can guide us. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that when we talk about how people get radicalized, when we talk about how people find themselves in believing bad things that then lead them to do bad things, we tend to place our focus on this contagion model where we say, oh, well, the reason you believe that terrible thing is you got really close to someone who believed the terrible thing and somehow they changed your mind. And people do change their minds. I'm a great believer that people change their minds through argument. That is, like, my whole, you know, belief system and theory of change for the world is that if we say true things and we make them plain and compelling enough that other people will see our truths. But again, there's very little to suggest that the people making the argument for the flat Earth are more compelling now than they were 30 years ago. And if anything, they're less compelling because, you know, this is the age in which your kids' high school hackerspace can make a balloon that will sail a GoPro camera high enough to see the Earth's curvature, right? So there's never been a time when it was easier to debunk flat Earth. And so what we're left with is this kind of grasping around for why bad ideas seem to have become so prominent. And I'm only left with the conclusion that the reason they become more prominent is because we are in this state of trauma, that we are in this point in which we don't really know whether a bridge is going to fall down or our water is going to poison us, or the research that our doctor cited to tell us that these opioids that she just prescribed are safe will turn out to have been expensively procured by evil billionaires. And in that world, I think radicalization comes easy.
He goes looking for a place online, like so many of us do, and he discovers a website that we can't fully name on the radio, so let's just call it FCRIIF.
Right.
Tell us about that website and his complex and developing relationship to it.
So it's a website that, like so many websites, provides support to people who are going through tough things in their lives. And the inspiration for that website was the first incel website. Incels are a misogynist cult of now, I think, exclusively men who believe in a kind of elaborate conspiracy theory or bad science theory about evolutionary psychology that says that only certain kinds of men who have certain kinds of facial features and so on will get sex from the right kind of women. And they believe themselves to be the wrong kind of men and therefore unfairly deprived of the sex to which they're entitled. And famously, incels have committed a string of mass murders in the last 2 years. What's not well known about incels and what ties directly into the story is that the incel movement was inadvertently created by a queer Canadian woman who coined the term incel, involuntarily celibate, to describe her own loneliness and her own feelings of anxiety and inadequacy because she had not been able to find someone to be physically intimate with. That's a very hard place to be. And she started this message board, and she had this discussion with these people who came along to join her and discuss it. And one day she woke up, she had a realization that in most support communities, the elder statespeople are the people who got better. Right. If you're on a message board for people who struggle with alcoholism, the people who've been there the longest have been on the wagon the longest. And when you fall off the wagon, they're there to tell you it gets better. They're there to give you the benefit of their experience. But that the incel message board, for whatever reason, the only person left behind who'd gotten better was her. And the other people who were still hanging around on this message board after years and years were the people who were irredeemable, who were completely incapable of locating someone to love and whose bitterness had turned in on itself. And when there was a new member of this message board who was struggling with trauma and self-doubt, rather than being the sober voice of reflection and experience to say it gets better, they were there to say it only ever gets worse from here. And so the lead character of this story, Joe, he's on a message board for people whose loved ones are dying of cancer that could be cured, but whose insurers treat the cure as experimental, as a cost-saving measure, and who therefore have to watch the people they love best in the world die slow, lingering, unnecessary, painful deaths in order to enhance the profitability of an insurer. And in that toxic environment of trauma and of elder statespeople who know it never gets better, Joe finds himself surrounded by people who, when someone says, I don't know why someone doesn't just go shoot that healthcare executive, those people are saying, why don't you go shoot that healthcare executive? If you're going to kill yourself anyway, why don't you make it count? And even after his wife has a miraculous, spontaneous remission, Joe realizes this dynamic is underway and he decides he needs to stick around and try and save the community from itself.
This story features somebody who does begin to engage in terrorism. And I know you don't condone this kind of violence, but the story has a kind of nuanced view of it. So I wonder if you could talk about that. I mean, one does kind of understand where it comes from, which is a very uncomfortable place for the reader to be.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, everyone who's ever cheered on a revolutionary struggle has to contend with the fact that not everyone who's on your side turns out in the final analysis to have been on the side of the angels. And I don't really care which side of any revolutionary struggle you're on. You have to contend with that. If you're cheering for Reagan as he's arming the Contras, you do need to make your peace with the fact that the Contras then tied American nuns to trees and bayoneted them after raping them, and that they were on your side and they were your good guys. You know, anyone who cheered on the struggle for self-determination in Ireland, anyone who watches Hamilton and cheers for the American revolutionaries has to contend with the fact that rights are never given, they're only taken, and that that process is messy. And that process also often involves people who, in the light of sober day, after the dust has settled and the dead have been buried, you look on them and you realize that they were not merely engaged in an excessive zeal, but that they were psychopaths or sociopaths who happened to be useful to your cause, but who you ultimately either have to disown or make peace with.
Cory Doctorow talking with Writer's Voice in September about his collection of four novellas, Radicalized. And again, you can hear the rest of that interview by going to writersvoice.net. So, those were four of our top 10 in 2016. The remaining six are Briallen Hopper talking about her wonderful collection of essays about all kinds of love, Hard to Love, Essays and Confessions. Jason Green talking about his memoir of losing his two-year-old daughter to a terrible accident, Once More We Saw Stars. We talked with Eric Blank about Red State Revolt, his examination of the teacher strikes in West Virginia, Oklahoma, and Arizona. Nora Krug told us about her graphic memoir exploring her family's history during Nazi Germany. It's called Belonging, A German Reckons with History and Home. And playwright and author Octavio Solis shared with us his stories about growing up the son of Mexican migrants in El Paso, Texas. His book of stories based on that history is Retablos. And finally, our conversation with Richard Louvre about his eloquent plea for us to better understand our connection to the other animals we share this planet with, our wild calling. Go to writersvoice.net for more information about those books and those authors and to hear the entire interviews. And a very happy holidays to all of our listeners. We've got lots more great shows coming up in 2020. We'll continue the conversation. See you then. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.